We're broadcasting from the offices of a project they hope to get off the ground here called it's Earth Station Roswell, and it's we're going to be talking to Tom Armstrong a little later about all the plans, but right now we have Stanton Friedman, who is synonymous with Roswell. You know, Stan, it's always great to have you on the show, and you've been to Roswell probably 200 times?
No, less than 100.
but a lot. You know that drive from Albuquerque to Roswell pretty well.
You know, I use that as an example. People say, well, how come if what you're saying is true, no, but the government hasn't taken you out sometime,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I say, look, they've had every opportunity. I have a live answering service. I give them my detailed itinerary, and there's that 200-mile drive with no traffic for most of the way. If anybody wanted to take you out from Albuquerque to Roswell, it would be the easiest thing in the world.
No big black trucks without trailers chasing you or anything.
I've never been threatened, and some people can't understand that. And others I tell, look, maybe I'm doing exactly what the government wants, helping the world to wake up to alien visitors without them having to explain anything, and softening them up until the big day comes. You know, I won't say D-Day, but R-Day, U-Day, I don't know.
you wrote an interesting review about Body Snatchers in the Desert, the Nick Redfern book. And Nick, he's given the same story to several people. He said, oh, I can't go to Roswell. I got this Mexico vacation I got to do. I like Nick, a nice guy.
So do I. I've spent time with
that. That's a pretty far out theory. I don't know. What do you think about it?
Well,
I read your review. I know what you think about it, but let's talk to the audience about it.
The kicker is here. I can't deny that there may have been all kinds of nasty medical experiments done by the Japanese, the Germans, the U.S. government as well. There's a long history of people doing things without permission and that violate rules and stuff like that. And I'm not fighting that idea. The problem is I can't find a connection between the story as he paints it and what happened at Roswell or the plains of San Augustine. In other words, we have descriptions from witnesses who were there, people like Jesse Marcel, Major, who went out to the site, like the rancher, the rancher's son, pieces, people like this. And I can find no connection. One of the things Jesse stressed to me when I first talked to him in 1978, was that there was nothing conventional there. He kept looking. He'd been at crashes of aircraft before. You expect vacuum tubes, you expect wires, propellers, rivets, little tags that say made in Oshkosh. I mean, the standard stuff was this Horton Brothers, supposed Horton Brothers flying wing. I mean, you realize how complicated the story is. We got Japanese that are disabled, who have been used in some nefarious experiments that are crewing a Horton Brothers flying wing, which the one that's in the Smithsonian is made out of wood. And yet the government in late 1947 sent out instructions, Counterintelligence Corps people, so look for the Horton Brothers. We're talking July 47, these instructions went out after that. He's got a Horton Brothers flying wing suspended from a huge balloon. Yes, the Japanese had plans to use balloons. They sent all these so-called fugo balloons over, and the press was told not to say a word about balloons that exploded, and a couple of people got killed, fires got started. They were in the Pacific Northwest. They certainly didn't come down here. There's a few mountains in between. Yes. And so we have a compounded unlikelihood, so to speak, and no connector. Jesse didn't see bodies right there. Nick mentions Frank Kaufman's discussion of a 9-foot piece of wreckage. Well, we all know now that Kaufman was blowing smoke, I think enjoying every minute of it, but it's been discovered that he faked some documents. I asked him in his house, where I was by invitation, if that original part of his story, that he supposedly woke up Colonel Blanchard in the middle of the night here in Roswell, and Jesse Marcel, and they all went out cross-country in the middle of night to a place that the owners say later couldn't have been gotten to except on horseback. They found the craft, they found the bodies, they called the base, a flatbed truck went out, and by morning it was all gone. Now, if you've been out in that area, it's several miles off the road, and there ain't no way to get a flatbed truck in there in the middle of the night, and nobody who's ever had anything to do with military accidents is going to remove the wreckage right away. You have to study it in place so you know what the character is. You know, the landing gear up, down, the flaps up and down, whatever. You take pictures. So the story didn't make sense in the first place, and Blanchard wouldn't have gone out without knowing what was there. He's the commander of the most elite military group in the entire world, the 509th, right here. And I asked Frank when he made this original discussion, wouldn't he have waited for spotter planes to check it out? No, we didn't have any spotter planes. Well, they did too have spotter planes. And the thing is, once you look out on the desert here, no trees, anything metallic, if you're in the air, as Don Schmidt and Tom Carey have done, fly out over that air, you spot it immediately. So the next day, undoubtedly, you sent out spotter planes to look at things. So Frank's story didn't make any sense and has been publicly refuted by the guys who stood behind it the most, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt. Mm-hmm. So there was another possible link that doesn't make any sense.
You know, you talk about that area out there. I've never been out there. You were out there yesterday in a suit for 3 hours. Hottest day in history of Roswell, you told me.
For that date.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a record setter. I put up with the Roswell heat out in the desert.
For a TV crew.
Yeah. There was a water girl there. Her job was to hand me a bottle of cold water in it every so often.
Laura Hell from our staff is from Wisconsin. She had a heat stroke yesterday.
Well, I can understand that. Where I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick, it never gets over 100. It'll get down to minus 30, but it doesn't get over 100. But there's another part of Nick's book that's particularly significant to me. In between 1956 and 1959, I worked on the General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Program. We were developing nuclear airplanes. It was not a small effort. In 1958, we were spending $100 million a year. We had 3,500 people full-time, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. Now, Nick's discussion about this is that this flight with these disabled people, who nobody would want to admit we had ever had anything to do with, and I can understand that part of it, was involved with radiation shielding experiments for the NEPA program, Nuclear Energy for the Propulsion of Aircraft. I was well aware of that program. I worked on it for 3 years. I worked in radiation shielding. So in the first place, the scenario he describes doesn't make any sense. That's not how you do shielding experiments, put people up in a crazy vehicle and let it fly around. Where's the radiation source? You do controlled experiments where you know what the source is, a nuclear reactor, because aircraft nuclear propulsion systems have reactors on board. And they emit neutrons and gamma rays, and those are the bad guys. And you try to get shielding in there without exceeding the weight limits for the airplane. And it's a high-temperature system. We operated jet engines on nuclear power in 1958.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You take the air and you heat it with nuclear energy, and you run it out from the compressor, heat it and run it out the gas turbine at like 1,800 degrees. So it's a very high performance system. And many people don't know that we actually tested systems out in the desert in Idaho, not here. It wasn't as hot up there. I've been out there too. But Nick he quotes from some document where Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which is where NEPA originally was, was a small effort, a study effort. Spent a few million bucks, Fairchild Aircraft and Oak Ridge. He says after 57, the project died out and was finally canceled by Kennedy in 61. But that's when industry came into the picture, 57. Not only were we at General Electric working on it, but Pratt Whitney Aircraft, the two big engine manufacturers, of course, had a program as well. They were maybe spending $40 million. We had two different approaches. We had the direct cycle. Air comes in, gets compressed, goes right out. Air is a lousy heat conduction system. They used liquid metals, which are corrosive as can be. You heat the liquid metal and the reactor can be much smaller, lighter weight. But then you got to transfer the heat from the liquid metal to the air to get it through the turbine. And then you got the other corrosion problem. The things that are resistant to liquid metals are not resistant to air at high temperatures. So they were struggling away. They didn't operate an operating system, but we did. So I can't find any indication that there's anything related to radiation shielding that goes with the story of the disabled people. I'm not saying there weren't disabled people who went through terrible experiments with the Japanese group put seven.
Yeah, we don't have a very good record in that area anyway.
Yeah, there were people who were exposed to plutonium, incidentally, intentionally. And it didn't become a story until the New York Times picked it up, but the Albuquerque Tribune had it years before. You know, it doesn't matter if it happens out here, if the New York Times or the Washington Post doesn't grab it. Incidentally, many of the people exposed to plutonium lived long lives. For those who think it's the most deadliest substance on the planet, it isn't, but that's all right, too. So, I like Nick. We've been at archives together. One complaint I had that it turns out wasn't quite justified was he doesn't tell us anything. He's got these sources, the Black Widow and a colonel, who seem to know a lot about the history of ufology and so forth and current players in the game and all that sort of thing.
Do you have any idea who those people are?
Well, I know that Nick knows who they are. No, I don't. But he has done some checking on them, which he doesn't mention in the book, so you can understand my not knowing about it. I mean, I'm skeptical of whistleblowers. I've engaged in discussions with Dr. Michael Sala, with Alfred Weber, people who come forward and say, hey, I was there, I know all about it, but who don't provide anything. And I know that some of them are totally untrustworthy. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but I've caught people in serious life. Well, Bob Lazar is an example of that, claiming to
Bob now lives in New Mexico.
Yeah, has a company going, he's selling widgets relating to nuclear stuff. He's not the only one, though. Guy Kirkwood claimed that he was a jet pilot for the Air Force, and his job was to take pictures of flying saucers. And to make a very long story short, he was never a jet pilot in the Air Force. He was cleared for single-engine aircraft, yet he claimed he flew DC-8s for United Airlines. And he couldn't provide his DD-214 discharge paper, which every veteran has and is important to, because it was in a box of papers that fell off the truck when they moved. And my dog ate my homework, too. You know, it's that kind of a story. And there are a whole bunch of these things, and I even mentioned in my review, much to the dismay of Colonel Corso's son, who called me about it, that Colonel Corso was a whistleblower.
Yes, right.
He was there, he handled this, he handled that, he arranged to slide all this technology into industry. And when you start checking, you can't find substantiation for any of those stories. And as a matter of fact, a man just died, Jack Kilby, who got a Nobel Prize in physics for work that he did in 1958 for Texas Instruments on microcircuits. The chip guy. Yeah, the chip guy. That's a funny title for a guy. You know. Is that chocolate chip?
Well, you know, in Dallas, they got Lay's chips and they got computer chips.
Yeah. And he got a Nobel Prize for work done in 1958. Well, Corso didn't join the Foreign Technology Department of the Army. Some people think he worked for the Air Force at Wright-Patterson. Not so. I was there at that time. It was a big outfit. I was doing a study on Soviet technology with regard to nuclear power in space. So I know about FTD Air Force. Corso claimed that he was responsible for getting that work done. His son was not happy with me when I said here was a whistleblower who hadn't told the whole truth. I'm sorry, I got to call him as I see him, but I always try to do my homework before I call him because my neck is out there. You know, somebody's going to cut it off.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's an interesting theory. Call it the theory of the month, if you will. How many stories have we had about Roswell? Let's see. It was a flying disc. No, it was a Mogul balloon. No, the dummies, there were crash test dummies, none of whom were launched until many years later, you understand, and who were 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, rather than little guys, aside from little details like that. And now we got Japanese victims of the terrible unit number 731. And so I'm disappointed that there isn't more solid data. I like Nick. He is a solid researcher. He spent, unlike some of the armchair theorists in this field, who, you know, pass on the MJ-12 documents, and, well, that document doesn't look genuine to me, or that date format is wrong, but they won't go to the archive to see how many different date formats were in use at that time, things like that.
Yeah, we've done shows on that.
Yeah, it's almost as if there were an ongoing attempt to keep the story, sort of to kill the live story by coming up with a new explanation from time to time. And Dr. Bruce McAbee has pointed out that for the skeptics, there's a standard procedure. You try an explanation. It doesn't work, try another one. That one doesn't work, try another one. try again and again because we know it can't be real. And that's not science. It's not journalism. It's nonsense. You know, it's propaganda. Call it what you want.
You mentioned nuclear. We need to talk about your background. You actually worked on the space engine?
I worked on I set a record for working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs. But I did it at little companies like General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, McDonnell Douglas, TRW Systems.
Well, I guess it was the fee you were charging. They had to cancel it. Went over.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
Hey, my first job in industry, I had a master's degree in physics. I started at $58.56 a year. And I thought if I ever got to $10,000, I'd be in heaven.
Wow.
And times have changed a little bit since then. So that's why I say when we were spending $100 million...
That was a lot of money.
...a year in 1958, that was a lot of money. It really was. But my specialty was far-out stuff, leading-edge technology. I enjoyed the work. It's a shame they canceled all the programs. But I worked on fission nuclear rockets, for example. We successfully tested them out near Area 51.
Okay.
In the nuclear test site.
You were responsible for that water tower. They had to build a new one.
I worked on fusion rockets back in the early 60s at Aerojet General Nucleonics. And nuclear fusion is kind of interesting. It's what goes on in H-bombs. We don't want to talk about that. But it's what goes on in all the stars. Any civilization that starts to get technological is going to realize that the source of energy in their star is nuclear fusion. Now, if you use the right isotopes, it's kind of nice because the right ones are hydrogen and helium. These are the two lightest and most abundant substances in the universe. So wherever you're going to go, you're going to find hydrogen and helium. Uranium you may have trouble with. As I remind people, this is the densest planet in the solar system. I don't mean the people, I mean the planet itself. And so there are more heavy metals here. It took them a while to catch that. Uranium is very dense. Gold, tungsten, rhenium, rhodium, these crazy metals. Well, that would be one reason for aliens to come here, because we know from our study of stars that the heavy elements are rare. But this being the densest planet, you'd expect to find those things here. But if you go back to fusion again, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. Not 10 million times. So I'm not saying we should build such a system because I don't think we should go to the stars until it's an Earthling vehicle as opposed to American, Chinese, Russian, Greek, whatever. But we do know about advanced technology. That work was government funded, incidentally. The problem with advanced propulsion systems, I just thought of a good conspiracy theory.
Can you approach the speed of light
with
that?
Sure. Look, it only takes 1 year at 1G to get close to the speed of light.
Okay.
I've had professors estimate it takes 1,000 years or 100 years or 10 years. One lousy year, and at 2Gs, it's only 6 months. So,
and it may be a moot problem anyway. I mean, there may be ways to circumvent.
We don't know how to warp space and time. I mean, just look. And I feel kind of foolish. I was at a college class last year speaking to the students, not taking the class, and University of Detroit, and I was talking about technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. In other words, a laser isn't just a better light bulb, different physics. The fission rockets and fusion rockets aren't just better chemical rockets, entirely different physics. And I said, heck, when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. I looked around the class. Didn't seem to get any reaction, so I asked, do you know what a slide rule is? Not one of the students knew what a slide rule was. Make me feel awful old, for one thing, but it does illustrate how much things can change in a short period of time. I mean, look at the old desk calculators, and my wife's got a computer on her desk that's got a 200 gigabytes hard drive, and today's kids take that for granted. That's an extraordinary stupid little device. So the world changes very rapidly once you get on the kick. And that's something we have to take into account. with how we think in terms of our local galactic neighborhood. Oh, there's another trick that the astronomers play.
You said in an interview the other day it was 54 light years for the local. Why 54?
Well, because somebody has tabulated that within 54 light years there are 1,000 stars. 46 of those are similar to the sun. This was in conjunction with the Betty and Barney Hill star map.
Yes,
So it gives me a way to illustrate that in our neighborhood, within 54 light years of here, which is nothing. I mean, the galaxy is 80,000 light years across. So I'm talking about neighborhood, down the street, around the corner, you know. There are 1,000 stars. 46 are similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets and life. And the two I'm most interested in, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, in the constellation of Reticulum, and I didn't make up the name. It means the net in either Latin or Greek. I'm not sure which. You can't see them from here. You've got to go down the equator. Here we have two sun-like stars that are only an eighth of a light year apart. That means they're more than 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. They got next door neighbors, and it just so happens they're a billion years older than the sun. So that's the point of saying that progress comes from doing things different. The first place they'd have more incentive to go someplace else, because there's a neighbor down there. And in the second place, they've got a billion year head start on us, which means they ought to be able to figure out something about which I know absolutely nothing.
You're going to be at MUFON later in the month. You got to up in Denver, and we have a link to that website. And your website's very interesting, too, stantonfriedman.com.
That's right. It's easy because I had a complicated one, so we managed to get a simpler one. Yeah, my paper in MUFON now is going to be quite different. It'll be Government UFO Lies. That may shock some people that I think the government lies, but I will document it.
How long is the speech going to be?
I think I only get an hour. I can't cover all the lies in an hour, but I have a written paper that'll be in the proceedings. I mean, come on, you know, there are lots of lies around. I do occasionally come up with conspiracy theories just because people accuse me of being a conspiracy theorist, and I say no.
You've got to live up to a reputation.
Well, I show up blacked out documents and whited out documents. I don't talk conspiracy. Great for a laugh, incidentally. But one conspiracy theory, and we may have talked about this before, has to do with that Peter Jennings special.
Yes.
That somebody decided, what's the best possible way to find out the present state of the art of ufology? How can we get all the experts in the field to spill the beans, you know? Well, what better carrot than a...
Which they spent about 100 hours a day, maybe 200. You spent a long time.
Closer to 300. They interviewed 150 people, which is far more than you need, Jerry, for the two-hour show.
Sure.
Come on. They spent a ton of money going all over. What I'm suggesting is that some guy who works for MJ35 is watching 300 hours of tape. Because they interviewed so many good people whose tapes they use none of. I mean, Dr. John Mack from Harvard. Who better to talk to about abductions, especially when you got two psychologists instead of a psychiatrist saying it's all sleep paralysis. They talked to Dr. Bernie Haish, co-author of a paper that shows with modern physics, trips to the stars are not out of the question, significant aspect. They talked to Dr. Richard Haynes, worked for NASA, is retired now, worked with the astronauts, has collected more than 3,000 pilot sightings and worked with a lot of abductees. They talked to John Schussler, aerospace engineer with MUFON, 35 years with McDonnell Douglas now. He's retired from McDonnell Douglas. He arranged all kinds of interviews for them at last year's MUFON conference. Not one word. The only investigator they showed was Peter Davenport by himself up in Washington State. MUFON's got 3,000 members.
Yes.
You know, so I'm sure somebody looked at all this stuff and said, this guy's talking too much, that disinformation worked well, look how this guy repeated it. You know, that's a conspiracy.
Well, I like it.
And I did come up with another one.
I like this.
Well, in the sense it makes sense. Why would you talk to 150 people and only use from 50 and then trash Roswell as much as they did? That was the case that they put the biggest stamp of disapproval on, if you will.
It was amazing to me.
I don't mind being called a promoter if you also mention I'm a nuclear physicist and I spend thousands of dollars and thousands of hours doing research. but just the promoter, and then saying Roswell is a myth four times, and saying the witnesses crawled out of the woodwork. I wish they paid my phone bill for all the calls I made trying to locate people. This is before the internet. You couldn't just plug it in, you know. And they said not a shred of evidence. I sent them, believe it or not, they wanted tapes with me on it so they could use bits and pieces. I said, well, I got a lot of them, but I don't have time to go through all this junk. Oh, send them to us. We'll go through them. Sent them 57 videos, including the 105-minute recollections of Roswell with firsthand testimony from 27 people. They didn't use any of that stuff.
Can they buy those videos on your website?
They're noted on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com.
The reason I asked, somebody needs to see them. ABC got to look at them.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So, you know, that's bad journalism. It's dishonest journalism. If there was a way I could sue them for hurting my reputation, but I can't show that it cost me money, which is what you have, you know, if somebody would call me and say, I'm going to cancel your lecture that we've got scheduled because I saw you on that stupid program and we don't want you, then I could sue them, you see. But, you know, the crazy thing, Jerry, I've done more darn video interviews in the last few months than the previous months. Now, I don't know whether it had to do with that or just UFOs are hot right now. Would you believe that on this past Monday, a week ago today, an English company brought me down from Fredericton, New Brunswick, to Boston, then I drove 130 miles up to New Hampshire, and I was at the actual location of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case with Betty's niece.
You were.
Betty's dead now, but I had met, I'm one of the few who's old enough to have met Betty and Barney. He died in 69.
What was your impression of them?
I was very favorably impressed, and that's why when I was asked to look at the star map work of Marjorie Fish, I did so, and I was the first to publish about that work. Mm-hmm. I've been in Betty's home. We've done shows together. I was very favorably impressed, and I was with her niece, who has all her papers and the tapes and all that sort of stuff. But here it takes an English company to bring me down, and, you know, and I just spent these 7 hours out in the desert, four one day and three the other. I'm still cooked, I guess, for a Toronto company. It's doing something for Discovery Channel about Roswell. And several other companies suddenly want interviews. So maybe it's good to get a negative reference from Peter Jennings. You know?
might be the secret to success. Who knows?
Well, didn't they used to say ban it in Boston, Jerry?
Yes, that's true.
The book will sell like crazy.
The more things change, the more they're the same.
Yeah.
We're about out of time here, but I can't let you go without talking about the book where you wrote the preface and then you wrote the end of it.
Yeah, the epilogue.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Braxton County Monster. There is some fallout from that, incidentally. This is the official title. It's the Braxton County Monster, cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster reveal. Happened September 12, 1952. It's a fascinating story. The author, Frank Fascino Jr., spent 10 years researching this thing, quietly. And Fate Magazine has had good reviews, and MUFON Journal had good reviews.
Rosemary Guiley from Fate's in our audience.
Yeah. So she knows about the book for sure.
And it's very perceptive of you to give them a plot.
Well, the interesting thing... Oh, you noted that. The interesting thing is that some people complained. We made it sound, Frank made it sound like there were dogfights between UFOs and fighter planes, and that didn't happen, blah, blah, blah. So we started looking through old books, old articles. We found a tremendous number of accounts of jets, American jets, and earlier some prop planes in 1952, taken off after UFOs. We also found numerous statements that indicated that pilots had been instructed to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when told to. Now, you can just see the cartoon capability there. You know, pilot points down to the ground, and the saucer guy, bye! And we also found an article, not in the New York Times or the Washington Post, unfortunately, where General Roger Ramey, who was the guy at Fort Worth who was involved with the Roswell, now he was a major general, got a promotion, I guess, for that activity, he admitted in a press conference that we had scrambled jet aircraft hundreds of times after UFOs. Hundreds of times. He didn't say a few times. Hundreds of times. And we also found a tremendous number of airplane crashes, jet planes, military planes. And it's one of those mysteries. I think there's, we've seen the tip of the iceberg, but for example, three pilots, each with more than 100 missions in Korea, this is 52, Korea started a couple years earlier, crashed when they came back to the United States. That sounds a little suspicious to me. There weren't any MiGs attacking them here. They certainly were in Korea. If you could get through 100 missions, you better know what you're doing in that airplane. You know, your luck runs out if you're not competent.
Yeah, they always had some pretty creative reasons for the few crashes they didn't admit.
Well, they were also planes that disappeared, never to be seen again. And in England, there were also hundreds of crashes in that time frame. So one wonders. I had mentioned in my little contribution to Frank's book that I had heard six different stories of more airplanes going up after a saucer than came back down. Three would go up, two come down, that sort of thing. And if I've heard six cases, and there's got to be a lot more than that, because I don't use these in my lecture, I don't brag about them so that other people will copycat kind of thing. Now, I think that we may find that there were a lot of airplanes shot down, disintegrated, call it what you want, by the UFOs.
You're talking 100, 200 or more.
Certainly more than a handful. If I've heard of six, there's got to be more. But what I'm saying is, this isn't just wild-eyed conspiracy thinking. The planes are gone. We've got one accident report. They used to be impossible to get classified.
Yes.
But after a certain number of years now, they're declassifying stuff. And the whole thing doesn't make sense. This is the one Frank talks about in his book, F-94C, our latest, most advanced craft. Conversations with the ground and these guys, and they suddenly disappear, and they search the ocean for days, the Gulf of Mexico, couldn't find anything. But when you get the full report, the times are inconsistent, the discussion is inconsistent, this guy says one thing, the guy at another base says another thing. So I don't know what's going on there, but I think that one of the reasons for government secrecy about UFOs might be to avoid telling us that a lot of our pilots have been lost to them. And you say, that's the craziest story you ever heard. We lost 166 men on military aircraft that were involved in spy missions near the Soviet Union, Korea, and China back in the 50s, 60s. That was finally acknowledged in, I think it was 2001, they gave out medals to the families of these people who had all been lied to about what their husbands, brothers, sons were doing. So there is, and some of those guys were captured and probably tortured too, incidentally, according to stuff that came out much later. So there is precedent for covering up what happens to pilots. I mean, who's going to correct them? Nobody there to say, well, I saw it all happen, you know. So that's a sad tale, but we're following up on it.
I wonder what kind of orders the Air Force has now in regards to UFOs. There's lots of reports every week on our sighting show about jets showing up.
If you talk to John Greenwald, who has the Black Vault website, which he's got, 200,000 pages of government documents on. Maybe it's 300,000. I don't know. A very young, vigorous researcher. Yeah. John managed to get statements from the pilot's manuals for our latest military aircraft, fighters and bombers, instructions on what to do under certain circumstances, including what do you do if you see an unidentified rocket, an unidentified surface ship, or an unidentified flying object. At the same time, he's getting letters from the Air Force saying, we have nothing to do with flying saucers anymore. And let me just tie that together with one little quote. General Carol Bolander, in 1969, was asked to review Project Blue Book. He had nothing to do with it. He worked on the lunar excursion module, which is high-tech engineering work. And in his review, in which he recommends, indeed, Blue Book be closed because it isn't contributing anything to science, etc., he notes that reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Two paragraphs later, he says, if Blue Book is closed, the public has no place to report sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security would continue to be handled using the regulations set up for that purpose. Has the press ever reported that Blue Book didn't include the sightings important to national security? And which are more important? What Joe Blow sees standing out in his backyard? Or where a jet pilot is going after the darn thing because it's gone down the runway at a SAC base? And I know of cases like that.
Yeah. We could talk for hours, but our time is up. You're going to be at MUFON in Denver July
21st, 22nd, 23rd. Yeah.
And
Government UFO Lies. Dr. Edgar Mitchell's going to be there.
Great.
We're on Saturday night.
Yeah, and we'll have John Schussler on our show tomorrow night.
Great.
So talking about all of that and a few other things. And Stanton's always a great pleasure to see you.
My pleasure to be here, even if it is so hot here in Roswell.
This is Jerry Pippin. Our on-location producer is Roberta Scott. Until next time, cheers.